galloping through the Bible text, and we'll continue for a time, and we are just trying to look at the 10, what you might call, main players in the Bible story so that we can get our arms around the whole story as a piece. And so we've talked about Adam and Noah, great men of the ancient world, from which we learn that we are creatures made gloriously in the image of God, and also creatures who are capable of terrible things. And we came to Abraham after Noah, and Abraham was a man who received a promise from God, and it was a promise that gave him land, that gave him a great big family, your seed, Abraham, even though he didn't have any kids, and a blessing, just as had been promised in the beginning of the creation. And then we looked last week at Moses, who led the children of Israel out of Egypt and brought them to a place called Sinai, and God gave them the law, and Moses helped them develop what we call the halakha, the way. And so it was how to live until this promised seed comes, how you maintain your distinctiveness in all the world as a people. And today we want to look at David, who was king of Israel. He was an anointed one, which is the same word for Messiah in Hebrew, Mashiach. And David was a small M, Mashiach, or Messiah. And so since we left Moses off at the end of his life, his protege, Joshua, led the children of Israel into the land, and they conquered much of the land. And there was a time, for a couple of centuries at least, of judges. And we read about all this in the book of Joshua and in the book of Judges. And the time of the judges, where a lot of our great heroes that we like to talk about in Sunday school, they make great stories, Samson, Gideon, Deborah, all those guys, they lived in a time that was described in the book of Judges as a time when every person did what was right in their own eyes. Now, that sounds kind of good to us as Americans, but I hope it's sounding less and less better all the while as we see this coming to fruition in our own culture. It was not a good thing. People were doing whatever they wanted and not listening to the God of Israel. And so there came this man that God appointed from birth, and his name was Samuel. Now, Samuel was the last judge of Israel and also the first prophet of the kings. Samuel was the guy who anointed Saul, the first king of Israel, because the people said, you know, this whole thing of judges and everybody just kind of doing whatever they want, we need a united government. We want a king like all the other nations. And that was something that God said to Samuel. Samuel, just give them what they want. It's not you they're rebelling against, it's me they're rebelling against. And so Samuel appointed Saul king of Israel. And Saul was exactly the king that made them think they had a king like all the other nations. He was tall, a head taller than everybody else. He was good looking, and he led the armies of Israel for many years. But in his later Middle Ages, he continued to disobey the Lord, and finally the Lord rejected him. He told Samuel, I have rejected Saul. I want you to go to the house of Jesse in Bethlehem, the house of bread, Bethlehem. I want you to go to Jesse's house, and I will show you the next king of Israel. And so he sent him to this house of Jesse, and Jesse brought out all his 7 oldest, best-looking sons. He had 8 of them, actually, but only 7 were there, and Samuel went down through them and said, Not you. Nope. Do you have any more sons? Well, there's the youngest, but he's watching the sheep. Go get him. And so David comes and he is anointed king over Israel. While there's a sitting king in Israel, a very, very dangerous thing to do for everybody involved. But David becomes the focus of God's coming glory. And that's something we have to learn for ourselves. We are here for a time, but God is always moving us forward. He has things he's teaching us and doing with us, but it's always with an eye to what comes next, the next generations. And so David's glory in and of itself was very significant. He is spoken of much more in the Bible. His name is mentioned almost 1,000 times in the Bible, even out, way outside of his own stories. He's picked up by what are called the latter prophets, you know, Isaiah and all those guys we know as prophets. In the Bible of Jesus, everybody from Joshua, Judges, Kings, and Samuel, they were all considered the former or earlier prophets, and Isaiah on to Malachi were considered the latter prophets. Well, David was born in the time of the prophets and lived, and so very quickly his name became a centerpiece in Israel's national identity in the prophets, and then certainly later on in the writings, which begin with the book of Psalms, and that the writings represent the time of the exile and beyond. And so the Psalms, half which is Israel's national hymn book, the Psalms, about half of them or more, are written by David himself. And so for the first time, when we come to the Psalms, long after David is dead and gone, when those things were all assembled together into a book, you begin to see into the mind and into the heart of David. Because what's talked about of David back in Samuel and Kings is really kind of opaque. You get his actions and you get his outward dialogue. Well, how much of what you think actually comes out of your mouth? Well, if you have any intelligence at all, not much. And it's in the Psalms that we begin to see what he's thinking and what's going on inside of him. David was a very clever man. You know that because he lived. He not only became king, he survived to become king. And so then we get David again in the time of the exile and the post-exile. We get his story retold in the book of Chronicles. And this time it's told without a lot of the bad stuff you get back in the book of Samuel, the books of Samuel. So Samuel is the one where we find out what really happened, and all the dirt and the grit and the dirty laundry is there. And so that's kind of where we'll concentrate today. But even after the prophets and the writings, when we get to the New Testament, David shows up all the way through the New Testament as a very important category of who the Messiah is. Are you the son of David? And David engages in a little dialogue with the teachers of the law at one point. He says, well, if David is calling him Lord, why is he also called son? You see, a son is usually not someone you call your Lord. So the Messiah has that unique category. And so all the way, even into the book of Revelation, Jesus himself from the throne of heaven is not ashamed to call himself the ancestor and son and root of David. Because David is identified with the central power structure and worship place of all Israel in Jerusalem. So let's just walk through the three segments of David's life. David as a boy, David as a man, and David as a king. Let me show you an amazing picture. This is David as a boy. He's getting busy early on with things. He's taking a stance in faith. He's holding there the head of the giant Goliath. In 1 Samuel 16, and you might want to turn there. We'll be looking at some verses and just kind of going through there a little bit. 1 Samuel 16 is where Samuel is commanded to go and anoint this young man, David, the next king of Israel. But that's not going to happen for over a decade. And it says in 1 Samuel 16, and here's the transition. Let's go to verse 12 and read verses 12 and 13. So he sent and had him brought in. That is, Jesse was sent and had Jesse sent for someone to bring in David out of the fields. So he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, he's talking to Samuel, rise and anoint him. He is the one. And so Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, who had to stand and watch their younger brother be lifted up and honored. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah. Now let's read the next verse. Now the Spirit of the Lord, now remember, the Spirit of the Lord has come onto David. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. So that was the change. That was the real change. The Holy Spirit, the actor, the one who is the motivator and the power giver, has come upon the new king already, long before he takes office, and he has left the old king, who has become corrupt and disobedient to the Lord. It's such an irony, because as you go on in this chapter, David is now hired to go and soothe this tormented Saul by this singing. He is known for his harp playing and his singing. And so he comes and sits very close to this man he's going to replace. And this is where we begin to appreciate the cleverness of David. The Bible holds cleverness up as a high value. It's a limited value, because Jacob was very clever, but his cleverness got him into a lot of trouble. And David's cleverness will get him into trouble as well. But it's really about being and doing all you can with everything God has given you. And so David is clever enough to go with a virtual death sentence on him. The fact that he's been anointed king means that he and his whole family, if Saul finds out, will be killed outright. There's just no question about it. And so he sits and he soothes this man with his music in his presence, surrounded by his bodyguards and his armies. And he's right in the middle of the most dangerous place he could be. And he learned as a young man to keep his own counsel. And then in the next chapter, in chapter 17, and I'm going to start reading at verse 38, and you can follow along if you like, we see David step out into the spotlight, and Saul really notices him for the first time. And David has come from his father's house now with some supplies to bring to his three oldest brothers who are fighting in the army of Saul. And he asked, what's going on? And what's going on is that very often in armies would do this. Instead of everybody getting killed, they would send out their champion and they would fight one another. That's where we get things like boxing and all that. It's easier to send somebody else to do that. Send your best guy, and it's a lot less destructive. And they've been waiting for many days to find someone who had the courage to face this Goliath fellow who was huge and a warrior. And so David says, what's the problem here? And goes and says, I will fight him. So it's in verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. Well, Saul is a huge, tall guy, and David is a young fellow of maybe 17. Clunk, all this stuff, chainmail hanging down to the ground or whatever. And David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off, and he took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. And I'm sure he had a stone in that sling when he approached. But this is who he was, and this is what he was used to, and this is what he knew how to do. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. And here we see the heart of David. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by the sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. You see, David understood what was at issue here. This was about who is going to stand up and represent the Lord. And if no one else is going to do it, I will do it because I know how to fight. I've been fighting off critters for my father's sheep for a long time. So this guy is just like one of them. Verse 48, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Now that's an Israeli thing still to this day. When you go on the offensive, you go toward your enemy, you go fast, and you keep firing or hitting or whatever you're doing until your enemy goes down. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the sheath. After he had killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. So, question coming for us, you know, what does it take to have faced down a wild animal that's bigger and more powerful than you by yourself? You're responsible for these sheep, so you have to fend away whatever's coming after them. He learns some self-sufficiency. Statistics tell us that a very high percentage of our national leaders, especially military leaders, come from the country rather than the city. They've learned some self-sufficiency. I saw even some of that in MacArthur, where I live. MacArthur was a town of 300, And there were about 6,000 people within a 30-mile radius, and it got even sparser after that. And even from that little church where I was pastor, we had one young man go through the Naval Academy. He's now a captain in the Marines, flying helicopters. We had another young man who is on the Navy SEAL team come from that little group of people. There's just something about learning how to do for yourself. What does it take to face off the enemies and deal with the responsibilities that you're given as a young person? And what does it now take to bring that up in front of the world, in front of armies, if you will? And wherein comes the ability to speak the clear truth? And so, for those of you who are young, I would say you have the strength of your youth. Do not waste the strength of your youth. Don't waste your time. Young men, your future is important. You may not think so, but God thinks so, and the people older than you think that you're important. Makes me very happy to see young people up here playing their harps and singing the praises of the Lord, willing to stand up and speak their faith. Young men, especially, the culture is against you. They're worried about your toxic masculinity. To them, I say, feh. Don't worry about what the culture says to you. You become the person God made you to be. You have a sacred duty to God, to your family, and to yourself to pursue what is right in this life. What you don't know is most of what's filling up the screen in front of you. I don't know how this is going to turn out. David didn't know either. Raise a family while you're young. Don't wait until you're 50. If you're going to raise a family, find a wife while you're young and raise a family. Protect them and provide for them. I could get shot for saying that these days. Do the thing that God has set for you to do in front of you. Don't just perfect your computer game skills and your skateboarding until you're 35 and then start thinking about life. It's happening. The clock is running. The game is on. And you have an obligation to the Lord, to your family, and to yourself. Young women, your future is important. You're not just here to hang around and see what happens. And I would tell you that the culture is against you, even though it purports to be for you. You have a sacred duty to yourself and to your family and to the Lord, to God, to your family and to yourself, to raise a family if you're going to do that. To get married and to have children and to raise good, confident children. We need children like that in this world today. We could use a bunch of them. And I think there are a bunch of young people like that in this church because people, young men and young women, have taken up God's call to be responsible adult people. And young women, don't be fooled into giving up a family for the sake of a career. Because I can promise you that in the end, a family will mean 100 times and more to you than a career ever will. I guarantee it.